our question at Ollie is always, how does it integrate? How does it integrate with our tech stack? Like, the integration piece is critical. And any service provider that is kind of still building this, like, you have to use us for SMS and loyalty. And, you know, that I just don't see that as having a viable future. Like, everything is about how these tools can work together.
This is the Commerce Experience Podcast. As a show, we aim to equip e-commerce professionals with the tools and insights necessary to thrive in this ever-evolving space. I'm your host, Elena Kachan, Community Marketing Manager at Bloomreach. Now, this is a really special episode today. We are at the Shop Talk Conference in Las Vegas, and we're in the media suite here. And today I am joined by Jennifer Peters and Philip Jackson. Jennifer is a senior manager of e-com at Ollie. Ollie is the maker of premium nutrition and wellness products, and with a mission to inspire lifelong healthy habits by bringing simplicity, inspiration, and delight into the world of vitamins and supplements. And Philip Jackson is a returning guest. He is the co-founder of the internet's favorite culture meets commerce magazine, Future Commerce. So thank you both for being here.
Ooh. Yay. Thanks for having us.
We wanted to talk about the evolution of e-commerce. And because the past decade has brought unprecedented changes to the e-commerce landscape, the democratization of platforms, the prioritization of simplicity, organizations have to stay agile and attentive to the customer's desires and expectations. So I'm excited to get into how Ollie is taking advantage of this and how they're able to execute an effective omni-channel strategy with cohesions across channels. So let's get into it.
I would like to kind of start by prefacing, you know, 10 years ago, we were using these giant clunky platforms with this incredibly high cost of ownership. And it's been beautiful to see the change and evolution to get away from this, like, everything's custom, you have to have developers on your staff, or you're going to pay an agency $30,000 a month for maintenance, simple things, to get to this place now where it's like, it's easy. Anyone can do it. Functionality overrides this need for customization. And, you know, I think Shopify is such a great example of a platform that literally any brand can use. You can be a single person selling a prototype product that you made. You can be a huge company, you know, there's, and sort of everybody in between. So it's really exciting. I love Shopify. I am a Shopify developer, and Ollie is on Shopify Plus, the enterprise version of Shopify. And I think for us, the main thing is really not overwhelming the customer with too many widgets and features and flashing and, you know, spin to win and kind of all of these things that are very distracting, and really just like, let our product do the talking. We have beautiful packaging. We have great products. You don't need a lot of extra stuff to sell those products. I mean, outside of like the educational pieces around, you know, adaptogens and probiotics and what do they do? Really, the product almost sells itself. We're very lucky.
That's why I wanted to interview you, because you have a really unique background, and obviously you have, and you guys are meeting for the first time, which is great. So yeah. She's got experience in marketing and coding. And so she's kind of the perfect person to talk about that whole journey throughout. So I'm really excited about that. And I'm curious, can you kind of talk to the audience about where you started and how you got to where you are?
Yeah. I mean, I started in brick and mortar. I worked at Barnes & Noble for 13 years.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, when I was a kid, I was playing shop, you know, I was like trying to sell things in my bedroom. I don't know. But I've always been a person that loves to get something in somebody's hands that they need, or something that makes their lives better. So started in books, was a director of marketing and e-commerce at a Christian church supply company in Nashville for 8 years. And that was really exciting too, because when I started there, basically the thinking was, if you know how to use Facebook, you could do this. There was just really, it was like print catalogs. That's all they did at the time. So it was really cool to build that whole program from the ground up and see it grow in this digital space and kind of go from there. Then I moved out to the Bay Area, did a couple different things, some startups. Like, I feel like everybody has to have the startup experience at some point. Did that, was fine. Didn't love it, but I did learn how to code there. A huge benefit, you know, the many years I spent as a director of marketing and e-commerce, there's so many conversations you have with developers around features and functionality and what you can do and how long it takes and what's a priority. And to be able to go and just learn how to do all of that myself gave me so much freedom to do a lot of things, but also to know that's not how long that should take, or that is an unreasonable excuse for why that can't be done. So I think it's been super helpful for me. It also helps me to really understand how, like, the whole technical landscape and the whole digital space really fit together from a marketing and an e-commerce perspective, both of those things together.
I feel like you architected this so perfectly. I spent 10 years. So I came up in e-commerce in a similar era back when I used to say when we were doing it on legendary mode, right? You had to build everything from scratch. There were no like paradigms or user like UX patterns for us to follow. We were all discovering it together. I built engineering teams in the wellness and supplement nutrition space for 10 years. And we had to build it in-house or hire an agency for $30,000 a month. And one of the amazing things was I would hire these agencies and I was having to educate them on how to do their jobs because people weren't e-commerce experts back then. In about 2012, I made the leap over to actually co-found the e-commerce team at an agency, which we then scaled to sell in 2020 to a global consulting firm. But then I became the guy who was trying to sell you $30,000 a month consulting.
The circle closes.
Right. These days, I run a media company called Future Commerce, and we are talking to executives and decision makers in e-commerce about what is around the next corner in their business. And I'm so fascinated, Elena, that the change of the conversation slowly over the last few years has been less about technology. And it's been a lot less about tips and tricks and features and a lot more about who are our customers? How do they think? What do we need to build for them for where they're going to be in a couple of years from now? Because nothing is done very quickly in our businesses anymore. And the way I say that sort of shorthand is like e-commerce at its core is solved. The way that you use e-commerce to develop a deeper relationship with your customer is the space that we all need to occupy. And so, yeah, some of these things are, you have, I talked to someone yesterday on the show floor and they're like bragging that they have the exact same team and the exact same tech stack that they have doing 700 million in GMV as they were at 70 million GMV. And the thing that they have had to scale is the logistics to serve that customer, which includes CX, and all of the things that happen in the post-engagement and retention. And that is software. It is e-commerce, but it's not the website. And so that's where I feel like a lot of this innovation in our ecosystem is happening. I find this really fascinating. It's a really interesting counterpoint that we have sort of Benjamin Buttoned each other's career.
Yes.
We're meeting in the middle of our lives as we're going the opposite direction. Yeah.
Both of you have way more experience than I. So maybe even talking about how the transition happened and I think the evolution of your tech stack, you know, the fact that they were, you know, bragging about the fact that it's evolved, but only logistically. I was curious about, and you and I talked about the high cost and custom coded platforms that people used to be on. And now everything is so much more accessible with platforms like Shopify and BigCommerce. How do you feel like that impacts the role of the marketer in the e-commerce in this space?
I think it can be really tough. And I also freelance a lot, and almost all of my clients are customers, brands coming off of Magento or Salesforce Commerce Cloud and moving to Shopify or BigCommerce. Like that is my customer. That is kind of my specialty. I think it can create some fear and it can create some excitement. So on the marketing side, you've got suddenly a marketing manager who's empowered and can actually do the things they want to do when they want to do it. So they become more agile. They can make pivots in a day. They can look at customer behavior and be like, no one's clicking on this. We're going to make a change right now. And I think it's really exciting and really exhilarating. And to be able to kind of pull in, as you were saying, Philip, like your people that are working on the retention space, like your CRM manager and your, you know, these other SMS and email, for them to kind of be more part of the core website, like even though it's not really the website, it's really MarTech. I feel like it brings everybody together. The downside can be that there are a lot of web developers out there, a lot of front-end developers who didn't make this evolution. I've worked at places where we had like 12 .NET developers on staff, and that's what they did, and that was kind of their limitation. So I think the developers that have been really successful have been the ones who have been able to pivot really quickly and pick up those new skills. Because if you're a Shopify developer, you can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
If you're a Magento developer, you might want to work on your skills a little bit.
I mean, COBOL still exists. There will be a job for somebody in the future. I agree with that, too. I would also add to that to say that the job of every company, too, and every brand is to remain culturally relevant as the world changes. And technology, your choice of technology in your career can make your career culturally irrelevant in this world. And so the types of software that people are becoming specialized in today, sort of like Bloomreach, is you have these tech stack platforms that have become ecosystems unto themselves that create an ecosystem that your team can sort of plug into and live inside of. And what I found is we don't, And I'd love your feedback on this. I'm taking over the interview.
Please.
I want your feedback on this because, Jennifer, this what I found is that we have software specialization, and I feel like that's the next scary thing in our ecosystem is people have become Yotpo experts, or they've become...
Yes.
And what you really need is people who have the skill of merchandising or CX or retention. They need a broader skill that doesn't live in one software. And that's where I think we need to transcend into. And I feel like maybe we had that at one point in the ecosystem when we were coming out of retail into this. Mm-hmm. Now we have all the software specialization. We need more abstract skills. But what are you thinking?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I think one of the things that used to happen is that you would go into your e-commerce platform with the intent of pulling data out so that you could do things with it. And now you live in the data, you live in the platform, and it's very different. And you do see these, you know, like there's a whole Shopify universe. There's, you know, all of the plugins, like they all have kind of their favored partners and all these things go together. I think that, you know, our question at Ollie is always, how does it integrate? How does it integrate with our tech stack? Like the integration piece is critical. And any service provider that is kind of still building this, like you have to use us for SMS and loyalty. And you know that I just don't see that as having a viable future. Like everything is about how these tools can work together.
I think the integration part is so important because you want it to work together. You want it to be smooth and seamless. And I think if you are working within these technologies, that's like number one. And I think for us, we always try to empower people who are working within the tool. And we have a lot of specialists who are working specifically in the tool. So maybe this is a heads up for them. If you're listening, kind of expand your repertoire, if you will, just to make sure that you're deadly on any tool that you potentially could use. But I guess, are you seeing that, Philip, in terms of brands wanting to simplify their tech stack and be all in one place at one time? Or are they, you know, working with multiple different tech companies? I think the integration piece is so key.
Let me come at it from a totally different angle.
Okay, hit me.
Which is most of the platforms, Bloomreach included, Shopify included, are feature complete for what you need. Mm-hmm. Every modern business needs to get their job done. What we lack often is what we have in a software specialization is our sort of favorite little gerrymandered line of the things we know and we like and know how to use. But what I've witnessed with people that are older merchandisers, career merchandisers, or they are from the catalog business is they have a better abstract understanding of a way to engage a customer. And they'll go in search of how to do that in the platform and get more out of the platform in the future. And so it's less about the, hey, we have these features. And it's more about the, I know the program I'm trying to implement. Surely Bloomreach can do that. Let me find what part of that helps pull together this customer journey rather than trying to apply a specific type of a piece of software. The best of the best in Shopify have done that. Mm-hmm. They see it as a means to an end. It's a tool, but the craftsman is the important piece of using the tool. It's not the other way around.
To be an e-commerce professional, you have to be an expert in so many things. It's overwhelming. You have to know fulfillment. You have to be a web developer. Yeah. You've got to be a merchandiser. You've got to understand the taxes, you know, sales tax collection and ADA compliance. I mean, there's so many things that you really kind of have to be an expert in. But I think it's also what keeps the business very interesting.
Speaking of keeping businesses interesting, I want to zoom in on Ollie and your work that you do with the advancements of technology and all of the data that you're able to gather. Personalization has become a really big piece of that and of the online experiences. People are coming to expect that from a customer standpoint. How have you guys embraced that? How are you thinking about it? And what strategies have you found that help drive most engagement and loyalty and keep people coming back?
Last year, we built a 3-year personalization roadmap. And we're living it, which is great. That's kind of what you hope to be able to do. So I think that the planning piece is really, really important. You cannot just go out and just hit everything and nail it. You really have to kind of start with the basics and add on and add on. The first piece for us was really doing quizzes. Like we never even did quizzes before. So we work with Jebit. We do these great quizzes.
So cool.
It's zero party data, you know, which is amazing and actionable in its own way. But also I think it makes customers feel like you care about them, that you have questions about their life and that you're genuinely trying to help them find the best product.
Right.
So, I mean, that was kind of step one for us. I think the other piece is really, and this is, you know, definitely a longer tail, is really understanding the behavior so that you can build around that. Mm-hmm. We use several tools that really help us understand the customer journey and the customer pain points and the drop-off places. And it's been really helpful for us too. As our brand awareness has grown, it's become more difficult because we're not like it used to be. We just had all new customers all day. They were just discovering Ollie and everybody was excited. And when you get to a certain maturity as a brand, that slows down. People know who your brand is. Mm-hmm. Maybe they buy it in a brick and mortar store. They don't want to buy it online. So there are, I think the challenges change, and the thing that we can do in the digital space, because we're an omnichannel retailer, we sell on walmart.com, we sell on target.com, we sell in all the brick and mortar stores. We have to look for, as digital people, like what can we do that those channels can't do? We have live concierge on site that works via SMS. So if you have a question, you can just text. And you know, most of our customers are mobile, as I'm sure most people's are. So using live chat on a phone is really painful. I don't know if you've done it, but it's rough.
Yeah.
So SMS has been a huge unlock for us and just kind of going back and forth around questions about product. I think loyalty is, of course, a thing. Building out loyalty program, loyalty points is very challenging when you're omnichannel because there's so much customer data you don't have. And there are a lot of times where you can't really know for sure if it's a lapsed customer or if they're just buying at Publix now.
Totally.
It's, you know, sometimes you just have to act on the directional information that you have and make the best decisions you can and not spin your wheels and trying to solve that puzzle because it's very, very hard.
I think that as we build our media brand of Future Commerce and we're trying to service more of the, you know, directors of e-commerce sort of job role and function at brands like Ollie, I'm hearing more about the, what is the role of the website in the customer journey? Is it to facilitate education for a brand like Ollie where I am trying to figure out what works for me? Let's, for instance, you know, there's a number of need states when you're taking supplements that you have a lot more consideration time where something like an Instagram ad or performance marketing works for things that you already know work for you. But when you're switching brands and there's an opportunity to maybe come in and conquest against one of your competitors, that's probably best done at the end cap. Better done than it is through performance marketing on the website. So I feel like the role of the website, certainly maybe in the 2008, 2009 era, everyone that was online was an early adopter and they didn't need much convincing. What they really wanted was a little whimsy and fun and feeling like they were part of a, you know, if you know, you know experience. Nowadays, the role of the website can be cooperative to your other channels. And I think the thing that is the challenge is making sure that you have a culture of leadership in the organization that sees it as such and resources you with financial goals, for sure, right? We need sales goals. We need sales targets. We need retention goals. But you also need other non-transactional goals that you're working towards in the role of the website and the organization so that you can be supportive to other channels. I think the most extreme example of what we cover in as sort of like a culture magazine is, let's see where other emergent brands, what they're doing, because they can be much more risky and much more experimental, and what can we learn from them? And one that's happened recently is Mr. Beast and his rebrand of Feastables has gone all the way in on in-store sales only and pulled back from website. And what I see that as a sort of channel experimentation vacillation is that where is his customer? Where does he want them to be? His customer is like 15 years old and is probably buying stuff in Roblox, not on a website. And so there's an understanding still that I think we're all trying to get around to is the role and importance of e-commerce and not to take anything away from it. It may look in isolation like e-commerce is growing, but the opportunity across all of your channels is everything else is getting bigger too. Right? And this is where I'd come back to you, Jennifer. When you talk about it at Unilever or within Ollie as a brand in the portfolio, e-commerce probably means a lot of things, not just website.
Absolutely.
Right? It's Amazon. Yeah. It's all kinds of
it
things.
It is. Yeah.
It's so Walmart.com, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. I'm glad you kind of brought this up. I think that it's a critical piece of leadership to not pit channels against each other as totally. Well. And that I've been in brands where that happened, where the sales team saw anyone who worked on the e-commerce site as a huge threat. We're really lucky at Ollie to have leadership that understands it, sort of like all, you know, everyone has to work together for us to achieve our financial goals. Obviously, we have financial goals for the channels. But at the same time, I think that is a cultural thing that you kind of either have or you don't have. It's either important to your culture or it's not at all. And once you start getting in competition with your channels, even if it's just, even if it's not even a customer based, it's just like a feeling like you want to, you know, you mm-hmm. got these feelings about the Amazon manager that you can't control. That is a top-down cultural thing. And, you know, I hope as, like you said, everything's growing. So I hope that as things continue growing, it'll seem less of a threat.
When things are good in a business, everybody counts the win. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're not hitting all your goals directly on, but we're all winning together. Yay. It's when things aren't so good in the business is when everyone gets really myopic around the programs that are in place, the budgets that are in place, the team structure. It's when we get a little riskier and say we need to make a couple more moonshot bets or we need to expand into new channels. That's where everybody gets really...
Squirrely.
Right. And I would say even sort of micromanagerial. Mm-hmm. It's like that's when people start fighting for territory. And so, you know, I would love your input with the arc of your career, when to recognize that from your seat in your organization is like either how to manage your way through that mm-hmm. or how you find an organization that supports the cooperative culture as opposed to the competitive culture.
That's a great point. So before I was at Ollie, I was at an e-commerce agency where I just built stores for brands, mostly brands in the food space and CPG, some supplements, some protein supplements. And that was something you would see a lot. And we really, as an agency, you know, my window into the brand was truly just like their website and parts of their tech stack. But what you can tell it, when you have this conflict, it just gets worse and worse. But, you know, for the most part, I think the business is changing so fast that we have to be able to evolve with it quickly. We are a foundationally brick and mortar brand. One of our sister brands, Liquid IV, is a foundationally digital brand. So the goal is to, you know, penetrate the digital space for us. The goal for them is really to kind of get wider distribution in brick and mortar. So it's really different. The goals are different. And we're kind of on like the different sides of the coin, the two of us. But at the same time, the goals for us are clear. And I think when the goals are clear, it's a lot easier to live into those and not get caught up on these little, like little small petty things when you know you're trying to just grow your overall umbrella, everything for the brand.
How do you prioritize and how do you ensure cohesion across all of those channels?
It's planning. Yeah. Planning is key. You have to plan. You have to have every channel involved in the planning. I think the big piece is the creative to make sure that there's that cohesion throughout channels. I mean, when you make a cardboard display for brick and mortar, you have to make that like a year in advance. But mm-hmm. while as on a website, you could make a homepage banner in 10 minutes and change it and be done. So the planning piece, the timing has to be right in order to keep those channels cohesive. One of our big seasons is back to school. So we have, you know, probably designed and built our cardboard displays for in-store 6 months ago. But right now we're just kind of planning the digital piece. But it's really just about pacing the work too and just making sure that everything is supporting itself. We are lucky to be a supplement brand and a vitamin brand. So customers don't change brands all the time. We don't have as much churn as, you know, I don't know, a company that makes towels, I guess. So for us, it's a little bit easier. I think the hard part for us is kind of tracking what channel they move to. Sometimes we can't, and that's okay. And we just have to sort of proceed knowing that that's going to be a hard thing to get at. But at the end of the day, it's just about bringing all the pieces together, make sure you're all planning together, and make sure all your creative is feeding into each other.
Do you work closely with your marketing teams?
Yeah. So at Ollie, we actually have a separate e-commerce team and a separate marketing team. So it's in a lot of brands, that's not the case. There's a lot of upside to doing it this way. I love it. And I usually, when people ask me like, what do you do? What are you responsible for? I will usually say everything but paid. All of our paid acquisition lives on the marketing side. And we have a lot of input into that. which is great. But we also don't have to own it day to day. You know, we can kind of put in our advice, put in our requests, put in our budget, and then move on and focus on the things that where we can really move the needle. So like first time conversion on site, getting people into our retention machine. Those are the things for us that we focus on is like conversion. Where are the obstacles? Where are people dropping off? We rely on the marketing team to bring us the qualified traffic that we will then convert. And we're great at retention. Once we get people in, we're great. Mm-hmm. So it's really about that whole first acquisition that's so big for us.
I would ask a question, just kind of leading back from the last podcast we did together around this, where the customer expectations, or what we posited was customer expectations had to do in years past, what we might have called the Amazon effect, where you had other experiences were dictating what you had to do logistically or CX-wise to please a customer. So maybe in a prior era was 2-day fast free shipping. Today, what is that? Because I think that those expectations are somewhat relaxed. Even Amazon is relaxing those expectations. They're incentivizing customers to relax those expectations. So maybe we theorize that cultural relevance might be the new customer expectation, is that I expect a pink Ollie gummy during Barbie Mania. What is your role in your business look like as to like, what is the purpose of cultural relevance within a company like Ollie? Does that even matter in your category? Or how do you think about that or approach that as a team?
That's a great question. I for us, it's our social mission. We are very much a mission. We're a B Corp. We're, you know, we are really in that space. And our mission is really about mental health. And the feeling is, you know, our slogan is happy inside out. And we don't feel like you can be happy unless you can be your true self and you can express yourself. So that sort of takes shape in our own workspace. It's very much focused on mental health and there's a lot of resources. And, you know, I'm Gen X, so it kind of weirds me out sometimes. But I love it. I love it. And I love what you were saying, too, because I think for Gen Z, that piece, that cultural relevance piece is going to become more and more important. And about just being in the right place, the right time with a real message and having a real purpose. I don't know that that's true for every brand, but for us, you know, that give back piece is really important to who we are. And it's about how we also live our lives as employees at Ollie too.
I love it too. I want to ask one more question though, is that there is something that you can strike and I hope you don't, you could even cut this out of the podcast, but my brand would ask the question, is there some power in being sort of like meaningfully generic? And I don't mean that by saying like, you're not a Gen Z brand, mm-hmm. but you're a brand that's approachable for all demographics. And I feel like it's through your categorization where you're finding a specific voice with a certain type of a customer, maybe through licensing or something.
Absolutely. No, I think that's so true. I mean, you look at, we have a lot of product segments. So we've got sleep, we've got gut health, we've got multis. And the place, the fastest growing section right now is really cognitive. And that's really where you see Gen Z kind of playing. They're not buying multivitamins. Gen Z they don't take supplements like I do, but they are looking for cognitive. They're looking for an edge, especially with the Adderall shortage. Not that that's related at all, FDA.
Sure.
But, you know, they're looking for alternative ways to kind of fuel that. Yeah. So it's a little different than, you know, our different demographics. Like our brand is for millennial women. Like that's who we are. That's kind of who we've always been. I think that piece for Gen Z, it's like, yeah, they like Ollie, but they like a specific thing. They're not taking joint supplements when you're 23. So it's just understanding how the demographics kind of split up.
They take their supplements with their joints though. Because the whole like Zen thing is really interesting. Cause I think there's a culture of vice as well that they can hold the vice and the wellness in at the same time as not being competitive with each other as part of their identity is like,
so true.
I want to be a little bad and I'm going to offset that by being pretty good too.
Yeah.
I don't know how many brands actually understand that that is the duality of their customers. Their customer is actually quite complex and you don't fit neatly into the, I want to be well and healthy. And no, there's some complexity to how we behave too. How do you play into that sort of a mentality with a coming generation that has more complexity as a customer? How do you learn from that?
New Year's is our biggest season. So kind of happy new you, like you're going to be healthy, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And what we have done in the last couple of years, which I love, is we've made it not about New Year's resolutions and more just about evolutions. Like if you could do one little thing that makes you healthier, if it's just taking a multivitamin, then you have won. And we built all of our messaging around that to not make this season feel like the season of failure. Because I don't know what the stats are and people not living into their New Year's resolutions, but I would imagine it's most. So for us, I think the messaging there was really important to be like, we're here to support you no matter what your goals are. You know, we want to help you, even if it's just a tiny little incremental piece of making your life better. That's what we want to do. So I think some of it is just setting goals that are realistic for your customers and not becoming this like overly aspirational brand where it's just like, oh, you just want to, you know, like Goop or something, like where it's almost unattainable. Like no one's ever going to be Gwyneth, and that's just how it is. So for us, I think it's really about just being practical, addressing the small things in your life where we can help. And also then making that experience delightful and taste good too. Yeah. And that's a key part of our brand, is that our stuff works, obviously, but at the same time, it tastes amazing. And it's a good experience. It's a happy experience. It's not a sad experience. So
it's wild to me. I'm so sorry. It's so important because there's a sexy brand on the rise that, you know, is take your daily greens kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it tastes like garbage.
No, it's so bad. This is trash.
You're just reminding me that being healthy sucks.
It doesn't have to be a punishment. Right. I think that's really important. I really do think it is. I mean, especially the gut health supplements that are out there right now, like the greens and the Bloom, and it's gross. It feels like you've been bad.
Yeah, you're being punished.
Yeah, you're being punished, and you have to do this to yourself every day for some sort of redemption. And
lame.
Like you can take vitamins and they can be delightful, and you can be like, that tastes great.
Yeah, I saw this article on New York Times Instagram, and it was that millennials, 33, we're kind of like the main character in our society right now. And I feel like if you're tapping into that mental health, making yourself feel good by just making this one decision and it feels attainable. And I feel like mental health is such a conversation right now, and everybody's trying to find, you know, be 1% happier, but like it's a mindset shift. And if you're feeding into like what they care about and what they're thinking and how they're evolving, I feel like you're always going to win, and you feel like you get them and you're speaking to them, and it's a topic of conversation. So I didn't realize that that was kind of your focus, but I think that's really cool that you guys are tapping into what it is that they care about. And like, there's so much nuance with how people make decisions and buy products. And I love that you said like the vice and wellness on one hand. I mean, yes.
Got your green drink.
Yeah. Like I'm
your beer.
Right there.
Put some vodka in it.
Yeah. Just throw it on in. So that's cool that you guys are thinking about it. And I think that's what makes you guys a cool brand and an approachable brand for all ages, but you know, you guys have that core too. So
it's getting really interesting too, because we were founded in 2015. So we're not even 10 years old yet, but millennials are 10 years older than they were when we first started. So it's been really interesting to kind of watch this. We have an audience. This is my favorite audience. We name our audiences. We've got personas. Mm-hmm. Then my favorite one is surprised to be here.
Like, oh, wow.
Oh, this hurts. This is bad. It's not getting better.
That's hilarious.
But it's been, as a Gen X person myself, I've really enjoyed watching millennial women get older.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Don't remind me. I'm like,
and Gen X is the least served customer.
Absolutely.
Category.
100%.
That is in its own right a whole other conversation.
That is a whole different podcast. Yeah.
For sure.
Too funny.
Yeah.
The last question I had was just anything that you can share. A lot of the listeners here are mainly in your space or practitioners within the brand, you know, directors of e-commerce and their marketing, and they're thinking about merchandising. Anything that you can leave them with in terms of like solutions or what to keep up with? I think we talked a lot about trends and where we see things evolving, but anything you want to leave the audience with or anything that they can take with them? My question was about asking about tech stack and best in class solutions, but you can kind of take it in whatever way you want.
Well, because this is the first podcast I've ever done where Gen AI was not the main topic, I'm going to throw that out there just to balance it out in the universe.
Good.
One of the things I would say for us, you know, we're highly regulated. We're in the supplement space. So customer facing AI is not on the table for us. Like we're never going to make AI generated images. We're never going to make AI created ads, ad copy, product copy, like that's not going to happen. But I think the place where you're going to see AI really fuel this business and drive that personalization is really in the back end. You know, helping us sort of bucket customers and high intent, low intent, being able to do analysis in a split second that can indicate whether a discount gets served to a customer. We're working with a company right now, a pretty new startup called Vandra AI. And that's basically what they do. You know, they rate your customers on the back end. And if they see that your customer's about to bounce, they will serve them a discount. And it's all based on the learning patterns and understanding where the, you know, the acquisition source and kind of what the behavior is and all of that. But that for us, I think is, that's like the best use of AI, is kind of using it to fuel these other things, using it in SMS to look at your customers and be like, see these trends and say, you know, this is a segment we think exists. You should market to this segment. It's taking a lot of the really time-consuming thinking out of it. And I think as this gets bigger and bigger, we're going to see more pieces of this tech stack with the analysis pieces that are fueled by AI. So I think that's really exciting.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we lean on that a lot in terms of predictive analytics and giving you some guidance and direction with all of the data that you have. So, I mean, I'm actually shocked that we didn't talk about AI the whole entire time and it didn't come up until the end. So that's amazing.
Like, I felt weird about
no,
it.
No, I'm glad you brought it up.
We were so close.
I know,
we're so close.
But I'm glad you brought it up because I think that's where we're seeing things, and this conversation is all about the evolution. And obviously, there's a huge boom right now. So it's not going away anytime soon, but it's just trying to figure out how you can use it and work it to your advantage. So
Gen X, right?
Yeah.
Gen Y, Gen Z, Gen Alpha, Gen AI.
So many gens.
One family of gens.
Yeah, exactly.
Literally. Philip, any last pieces that you want to add?
No, I just to sort of echo the, you know, the research we did last year, which Bloomreach helped to facilitate. We talked to 1,000 folks just like yourself who are in the leadership role in their organization. And what we found was the Gen AI applications that were most interesting to people like you, Jennifer, were the ones that helped them future-proof their career and not necessarily the ones that were turning the dial for their business yet, because there's a lot of uncertainty as to what can it really do for my company in the current state that it's in, and it's CX applications or it's UX applications. But I do foresee that me as a marketer, there is a future for me to be able to understand and leverage these tools into not just this role, but my next role.
And
that's, we found that as like one of the data points was 91% of people that we polled of 300 B2B marketers, 91% were using AI tools already, whether or not their corporate policies permitted it. And that just tells you everything you need to know, is that future-proofing is not just a function of your business. It's also a function of the people that do the job every day, is that you have to help them future-proof their career or they're going to do it on their own. So I think that like this, this personalization piece of this business is also, it's not just about the tool, it's about the person who uses it. And they want to know that it's not just for their current role, it's for them for the future too. Maybe that loops us back around to software specialization before. Maybe I shouldn't be so doggish on the software personalization specialization, because I think maybe that is the thing you carry forward to your next role.
Totally. I love all of y'all's takes. These were amazing. I think this is a great place to stop. Guys, thank you so much for joining us. And I'm really glad we got to do this in person.
Yeah.
Such a win. Thank you all for listening. I really appreciate it. Obviously, as usual, let us know what you think about this podcast episode. If you have thoughts, email us at podcast@bloomreach.com. And we will talk to you next time.